Welcome to Ballistic Radio. Join us as we discuss hard-won self-defense lessons, as well as the information you need to survive a violent encounter. Listen as armed professionals, industry experts, national champions, and gunfight survivors help answer all your firearms and self-defense questions while exploring your rights and responsibilities as an armed citizen. Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. And now, here is your host, John Johnston.
Welcome to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. I'm your host, John Johnston. Remember, you can always listen to past shows at ballisticradio.com. Get the latest behind-the-scenes info, arguments, photos, videos, monuments to our own ego, other stuff at facebook.com/ballisticradio. Co-hosting with me, Jack and Melody.
Yay!
Yay!
No, yay is my thing. You have to get another thing.
I've never been on before, so I don't know what thing I can have. You... Hip, 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 hooray!
Biting my style right off the bat.
I'm sorry.
Well, we're joined by William April today. It's going to be a really great show. But before he comes on, hey, Jack, guess what?
What's that, John?
This segment's brought to you by Tactical Night Vision Company. The night is dark and full of terrors. Or at least, it used to be. You know nothing, Jon Snow. But now we have the technology to fight the night. And TNVC is your one-stop shop for all your dark fighting needs. From the TNV PVS-14 Night Vision Goggle to the IR Patrol thermal monocular, and everything in between. TNVC can outfit your defense against the dark arts. Doesn't matter if it's your lost keys, the enemy, that little kid from down the street that likes to wander off. Home life's not good. Or maybe the baby raccoon that I captured the other night because I'm pretty sure he's orphaned since I killed his mom. Anyway, TNVC has what you need to find things in the dark. TNVC, now with financing. So, do you know what that means, Jack?
What's that, John?
In addition to owning the night, you can also finance it, which is actually really handy. It's kind of nice they did that because, you know, it's a big purchase, and being able to break it up into smaller, more manageable payments.
It's a smart call.
Yeah. Melody's just like, you get paid to do this?
It's entertaining to watch.
Yeah. So anyway,
it's still entertaining to listen to, but it's also entertaining to watch.
I don't know about that, but all right. Joining us, William April. William, how are you doing?
I'm fine, but I'm wondering if it's going to be really frightening to the enemy to say, TNVC, we finance the night.
Well, is it? Does it need to be frightening to the enemy, or does it just need to be where you can see them, but they can't see you? I think that's the key. And it actually reminds me of a quote by my buddy Sean, who has spent the better part of his adult life going and dealing with America's enemies. Nothing turns a gunfight into a shooting quicker than one side not being able to see the other side, or something like that. But anyway, so you've been on the show a couple times. The Dr. William April. Maybe with pants. I don't know. I'm not going to ask. Don't tell me. But for those that haven't heard your past appearances, can you go over your background real quick, and we'll go from there?
Sure. Same as I always say. I'm a mid-career mental health professional in private practice in New Orleans, Louisiana. Had some background in law enforcement before I went back to graduate school, and got into the business of tactical training through that strange area where mental health and the law overlap. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I have a private practice halftime and teach halftime. Most notably, my flagship course is called Unthinkable.
And I've been very lucky that I've gotten to not only take that class. We've hosted it the last 2 years in a row here in Ohio as well. It's an amazing class. So if any of you are listening and want to really see, I think, an amazingly valuable take on all the things that we do. Going to one of those is really important. I guess what I want to talk about is, and I never know what a suitable amount of time is before it's okay to talk about something like this, and it's not sensationalizing it or whatever. But there was, the terror attack recently in Orlando. And it brought to mind something for me. It seems to, you know, there both sides have politicized it and whatever, and I don't want to do that, but it has gotten a lot of people more interested in training. A lot more people in the LGBT community have been much more interested in firearms training now as a result of this. I guess my question for you is why does it take a very public yet, if we're looking at the numbers, statistically unlikely event to get people motivated when there's so many other examples of much more common events?
Sure. You know, it's a persistent problem in the health business. I mean, if we were to talk about morbidity and mortality, meaning people getting sick and people dying, the conversation would start and end with cigarettes, with tobacco products.
Right.
And yet nobody wants to talk about that. It's much more titillating to talk about Zika virus. Or, you know, necrotizing fasciitis, you know, brain-eating amoebas always get the top billing.
Yeah.
But it's a much more common event. I mean, the atrocity in Orlando speaks for itself. But I often think it takes that sort of shock to get people thinking. If it spurs thinking about their daily lives, I think it's fine. If it spurs thinking about how do I avoid a takeover mass murder in a nightclub, that's not fine. So it almost seems like the daily life puts us in a fog, if you will. We call it a normalcy bias, where we're just pressed by our own brain's pattern-making ability into seeing things as going to be pretty typical. And it takes an almost shattering event like Orlando to make us see that the atypical is dangerous. Now the trick is to get people to see the typical as dangerous.
So, as far as that goes, is it just people? I mean, really not wanting to realize or give any thought to the fact that maybe something bad will happen to them
and in their lives too on the micro scale. That's a pretty challenging thought, and it's frightening. And because it's frightening, people resist it. I once went 15 rounds with a. Formerly, sad to say, formerly very close friend, who refused to lock her front door.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I live in New Orleans, which is certainly a moderate crime city, edging toward a high crime city, and yet living in a relatively nice area, but she refused to lock her front door. And I tried everything. I tried logic. I tried scare tactics. And she finally ended the debate and pretty much ended the friendship by saying that she refused to live in fear. Now, what she meant and didn't really know was that if she locked her front door, she would have to consciously accept that there are people out there who might try to get into her house without permission and might do her harm. And in her mind, by not locking the front door, those people didn't exist. In the same way, the little child plays peekaboo and actually makes you disappear in their frame of reference.
Right.
And so, you know, a lot of it is what we call denial in service of the ego, where my denial allows me to have a certain belief, and that belief defines me and comforts me, and I don't want to entertain any thoughts to challenge that. It might make me upset.
Well, is that what – let me ask you this then. It seems like a lot of the reasons when I talk with people that are at least intellectually honest about it is, well, I don't want to go to class because I'm not good enough to go to class yet. Maybe if I just practice more – and then I train up to go to this class, and it seems like what they're saying to me is, I don't want to embarrass myself in front of other people, or I think I'm good enough now, but if I go to class, maybe I won't think that anymore.
Yeah, it really highlights that the training industry is compounding a lot of issues to really push upstream. You know, the first is getting people to take daily threats to themselves on a micro level very seriously. And the second is performance anxiety. I mean, what a marketing plan, right? We're going to hinge on two irresistible human drives.
Right.
But, you know, fear of embarrassment is unbelievably powerful. And you can tell that very easily by looking at the practice regimens of people who enjoy competing, even as amateurs in the shooting sports, and people who carry guns for a living, like police officers.
Right.
People will practice infinitely harder to avoid being embarrassed in an IDPA match in front of their friends than people will to save their lives, which is why police officers carry the gun as that most valuable piece of safety rescue equipment. one would think that their motivation would be life and death serious. But practice for them tends to be work. And so the amateur will practice much, much harder to avoid embarrassment.
Huh. Well, hold that thought, because we've got to go to break. Right now we're talking with Dr. William April, and you're listening to Ballistic Radio! Welcome back to Ballistic Radio! Brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of air rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. This segment brought to you by 6 Hour, now with more options. We're not all the same, and our carry gun shouldn't have to be either. 6 Hour gives you choices. With more models than the Bible's got Psalms, it's never been easier to find a 6 Hour that fits your needs. Or drop bombs. From the extremely versatile Striker-fired P320 with modular grip frame to the Legion Series P226, the single-stack P225A1, or the entry-level SP2022, 6 Hour makes a model that's right for you. Just don't ask for Callahan full-bore auto-lock. They don't make that yet. 6 Hour, when it counts. I came to drop bombs. So get up your seat and jump. Or no. Come on, Jack. I'm funny. Ish.
At nighttime, you're funny. This is...
Wait. Whoa. That went... Anyway. That went dark? Do we need night vision?
Thankfully, I financed some.
It's not cool, though, apparently. Not cool enough for Dr. William April, who is hopefully still holding. We've not lost you during the break, I hope.
No, in fact, I have more rhymes than the Bible got Psalms.
Well, there you go, because 6 Hour's got more models than the Bible's got Psalms, and apparently everyone's got more than... I'm sorry, I have to come up with pop culture references, and sometimes it's hard, and that's the best one I could do. So, anyway. we were talking about ego as a motivator, and the desire not to be embarrassed as a motivator. Why do people respond so much more atavistically to that?
Well, I think it sounds like a cliche, but the real competition should be with oneself. You know, we'd like to think that folks going to what I view as a skill building exercise. I think amateur shooting sports competition is a skill building exercise, but I've got to acknowledge a lot of people do it as an end in and of itself, but they don't view it as training or skill building or anything like that. I mean, I view it as crackerjack stress inoculation.
Right.
Managing the buildup, that anticipatory dread, managing stress, managing heart rate and stuff, and then having to solve a shooting problem, I think is valuable on its face. But, I think that's pretty clearly a minority opinion. A lot of people are there just for camaraderie and for fun. I mean, shooting is fun. It should be fun. But we'd like to think that people that are using it as skill building have a sense of what they want to get out of it.
Right.
I want to get better at reloads. I want to shoot more accurately. I want to shoot faster and break it down. But a lot of times it tends to be not goal-directed like that, but just to avoid a negative emotional state like embarrassment.
Let me ask you this. And this is something Jack and I were talking about the other day, but I've been doing this for a little while now, and I get a lot of people that ask me, like, what's most important? And they start asking me to, like, prioritize things. And I think – and I'm not saying that I've definitely come to this conclusion, but I think that I'm starting to believe that of everything that we do, the very most important thing is finding your ability to maintain your calm and rational mind in whatever you're doing. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think, priorities are incredibly important. First off, crush your enemies, see them driven before you, and hear the lamentation of the women.
Yes.
Now, after those priorities, the most important one is to very quickly manage transition from two competing and parallel systems within the mind. They're often referred to as System X and System C. System X is the reflexive mind, the mind that's unconscious, but that is designed to save you in a crisis, mm-hmm. right? Your mind responds reflexively to certain things in your environment. Now, your reflective mind is your thinking mind. And the part that does advanced, you know, cogitation. It's thinking about the world and deciding what to do. Well, either of those is incredibly unqualified to manage the opposing side of the street. The reflexive mind is not a thinker. It's a knower and a doer, but it's not a thinker. Well, if you let it handle crisis, perfect. That's what it's designed for. And you can think yourself into a disaster in crisis
right.
by thinking before it's time to think. And so when something startling, especially something novel, happens, there's a little thing we call the shock threshold,
mm-hmm.
where there's just sort of a pause between the event itself and any action we can take in response to that. So we want to get that latency, that pause, as short as we can. And that involves some, you know, struggling against the notion to see things as unreal if they're new to us. This can't be happening. You'll hear that over and over again.
Right.
In the aftermath of events, people will say it was like something in a movie, which is a dressed-up way of saying it wasn't real. And since it wasn't real, I didn't have to do anything about it.
Right.
So once we overcome that hurdle of derealization, then we have to let the reflexive mind do what it's going to do without the interference of thinking. But then very quickly, getting over that that overly reactive mindset into very quickly thinking, what can I do about this?
Well, so let me give you an example. I was very lucky that I got to Craig Douglas was in town not too long ago, and I took my son up to watch some of the 2-on-1 Evos on Sunday, because that's what I do, apparently. And he ended up sitting and playing iPad, and he didn't care as much as I didn't really think he would. But one of the interesting things that I saw when I was up there was a gentleman who was playing the good guy was attacked by an individual, and it ends up going to the ground. And this guy is controlling the guy on the ground very well. He's not a threat at this point. And the guy on the ground that attacked the good guy had a training Spyderco Pakal knife in his pocket. And the good guy is on top of this guy controlling him, sees this guy has a knife, very calmly pulls it out of the other guy's pocket and starts stabbing him in the face with it. And it's like, huh, that's interesting. And after the event was over, you know, Craig stands everyone up. He's like, well, why'd you do this? Why'd you do that? And then he goes, so why'd you stab the guy? And the good guy in this Evo is like, I didn't stab anybody. I didn't have a knife. And it was like, huh, is that kind of what you're talking about as far as an override of the reflexive mind overriding the reflective mind?
Exactly, because you'd like to think in that kind of posture where the good guy is on top and has the bad guy in a very disadvantageous posture, there's no reason to go up the chain of severity in terms of application of force.
Right.
And that's the funny thing is somebody's actions may look quite cool and calm. You know, we think, wow, that guy was very much in his right mind, unquote, his thinking mind, and he accessed that tool and then went to work. But the fact that he has no memory of it tells us that he was, in fact, overridden with stress.
Yeah.
And still in his reflexive mind, the desperate clawing for life kind of mind.
Right.
So in those kind of weird disjunctures, you can see the two systems. Where people fail is the handoff between the two systems. As long as each of those systems stays in its lane and we sort of use each to its maximum benefit, it works very, very well. You know, the brain has evolved to manage crises very, very well.
So how is there anything in particular that people should be looking at in their training to try and manage that? Or is it just one of those things we're getting the broadest exposure possible to the most varying conditions possible and seeing where you break down at?
Training that's very, very stressful, which is, like I said, another Cracker Jack selling point. Come to this training. It's stressful, painful, and uncomfortable.
Right.
Tough sell. And yet, it's only that pushing people to the breaking point, and Craig Douglas is a master of that, of pushing people right to the breaking point, but not to the point that they can't learn. He truly is the master of that after all these years. But only training like that can convince people that the breaking point exists.
Mm-hmm.
Most people have an overly generous view of how calm they're going to be under pressure because they've never experienced actual pressure.
Right. Well, and one of the other one of the other things Craig talks about is the danger of falling into judging our current capabilities and things off of past performance, you know, which is something that I was incredibly guilty of when I went through ECQC, was, oh, well, 10 or 11 years ago when I was in much better shape and, you know, working these sorts of things professionally, I can handle myself much better than I can, you know, 11 years later, 70 pounds heavier, not having been in a fight in the better part of a decade, you know?
Yeah. And you know, the word that in my mind is the clearest marker that someone is giving themselves the benefit of way too much doubt is the word just.
Mm-hmm.
When you describe a situation where you've been physically overwhelmed, let's say in ECQC, and that happens to just about everyone in that extreme close quarter concepts class, and when you try to describe it to someone, they say, well, I would just. And then they list some response they would have made that would have worked perfectly.
Right.
But when I hear just, my eyes sort of glaze over because I can tell that person is imagining what they do, not telling you a tale of what they've done.
Right.
And only that kind of stress that in the moment feels overwhelming, but in the course it's perfectly safe, as you know. You know, only that stress that feels completely overwhelming can show you that transition from types of mind, from modules of mind, actually exists and can have an unbelievably negative effect on performance if you can't manage it.
Right. Well, hold that thought because we have to go to break again. Right now we are talking with Dr. William April, and you're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio! I'm falling. Brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of air rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. This segment brought to you by Wilson Combat. Wilson Combat, makers of the finest custom 1911s and scatterguns since 1977. Legacy of quality, innovation, and service. Learn more about their firearms and accessories at www.wilsoncombat.com. So, we are talking with Dr. William April, and we were talking about pushing people, before the break, we were talking about pushing people to recognize where they sort of fall apart and working on that, and in the handoff between the reflexive and reflective minds. Is there anything else, I guess, associated with that people could start working on now before they make it out to a class like ECQC or any of the other ones that put you in that place?
Well, I've had the conversation many times with Craig and with ECQC graduates, and I argue that it's not so much a class as it is an audit.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to learn things. That's absolutely true. But it's not a typical class. It's more experiential learning and that gives you a snapshot of where you are, and that it's unscripted. Great chunks of it are unscripted. And that's a tough kind of training to find because instructors don't like to conduct that kind of training because the risks to them are greater. The class might go badly. So it takes an instructor with a tremendous amount of both breadth and depth, and luckily enough, Craig has it.
Yes.
But, you know, ECQC is a class where you sort of surrender yourself to the process and see what comes out. Now, what can come out is a total change in self-definition. I mean, it sounds kind of woo-woo, but there are people whose lives have been changed by taking that class.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't mean their approach to sort of self-defense. I mean, their approach to their own lives has been changed. So surrender to the overarching process of a class, that's tough. But embracing stress and discomfort is another. We don't like to do that. That's just human nature.
What,
you know, stress and discomfort are the things we're wired to avoid.
It seems like, too, and, you know, so one of the common criticisms I hear of, like, ECQC and other classes like it is it's too traumatic for the student, which I have my own personal opinions on. But it seems like that when we're dealing – when at the end of the day, what we're talking about is, hey, someone one day might try to kill you, and it's probably better for you to kill them rather than them kill you. So how do we get to that point? And that's not like a warm, happy, fuzzy subject. And sometimes people try and make it that, and I'm confused by that, you know?
Yeah, there is, I think, a kind of a pernicious mindset out there in training that every evolution has to end on a win. Every student has to end on a win. And it's a little bit, it's a little eerily close to everyone gets a trophy for me, which I don't think is a terribly helpful approach to children's sports, but certainly not to very, very serious things like fighting for your life.
Right.
Is it possible that students can be traumatized by training? Well, sure. You can make training that's abusive and traumatic. That's not a problem. That's why, the character of your instructor is so, so important. But it's also important to have people feel like they've approached the edge of control and a lot of times even gone over it in an environment that's safe. No one's actually getting killed in ECQC, whereas at midnight in the corner of State and Maine, somebody may very well be getting killed.
Why is it State and Maine is always where stuff goes down? It's a bad corner to live on.
Yeah, State and Maine is where some dude hangs out, apparently. Some dude that does all the crime?
Right. Right. That comes out of nowhere?
And it's always at 2 in the morning.
Yep.
But, getting people to embrace that loss of control, that's a tough sell. All of our performance fears and all of our even existential fears come up. When you ask people in the debrief of a real vigorous evolution, what happened? They don't say, well, this wasn't real. And so I have perfect recall.
Uh-huh.
It's real.
Yeah.
Chest heaving, breath, hearts pounding, out of breath.
Yep.
And it's not just from exertion. It's from stress overload and panic.
Mm-hmm.
And watching people panic in a disadvantageous position, it's hard to watch because they're learning a very unpleasant truth.
Yep.
But an invaluable truth.
So one of the hardest, and I, there's been various moments in my life that I have done difficult things. Or things that I found difficult or uncomfortable. Hardest thing that I have done in recent memory is going to the Sunday after the Saturday at ECQC, where everything that I thought I knew about how I would react in certain situations was completely wrong. And I'm better for it. And I guess what I would like to get people to do is realize that if we need to learn these things about ourselves, doing so in a relatively consequence-free environment is much better than, as you said, figuring it out on the corner of State and Maine.
It's a tough thing to ask of people, but viewing the class as an audit is helpful if you look then take the results of that audit and make changes going forward.
Right.
If you come back from a very demanding class and say, wow, I need to really redo my regimen of whatever defensive skill, then that's the purpose of the audit. What most people do, unfortunately, is during the time between getting crushed and going back to their sort of home base, they figure out a way to make the lessons actually not be meaningful. Well, that was unrealistic, and I wasn't allowed to do this, and I wasn't allowed to do that. When in reality, hard coursework should be open-ended enough that you're allowed to do just about anything.
Right.
And then see if what you would do when allowed to works.
Right.
But to use that information going forward is tough. It's tough to get people to embrace that because we all like what we do, and we do what we like.
And that makes a perverse sense. Let's shift gears just a little bit because as much as I want to spend the show talking about how awesome Craig is. He's doing okay on his own. He doesn't need any help from us. The thing that I guess has been, prevalent in the news, and we'll talk about it a little bit now, is the terrorist attack and the active shooter that ends in a hostage taking, which is, the conventional wisdom has been in recent years that as soon as a spree killer is confronted with oppositional force of any sort, they tend to take their own lives. But that doesn't work so much when they're religious extremists and they're trying to make a statement. What are some things that I guess we should be thinking about moving forward as far as the emerging risk profile that we're starting to see, or the emerging threat, I should say?
Well, I think one of the first is combinations of events, things that are both ballistic events and incendiary events. You're starting to see the use of guns and bombs together. And that sounds more, you know, conventionally terroristic, but it's quite common. I mean, if you think about Columbine, it was primarily an event that was intended to do damage with bombs, and that the only reason that most of the damage was done with guns was that the bombs didn't work by and large.
Right.
Well, better bomb making takes care of that. And the other is that the types of events that we're faced with are getting subdivided in some very unusual ways that challenge responses to them. You know, the initial response to mass killing events in the era of Columbine was create a perimeter and wait for the SWAT team to show up. Well, we know now that every minute that goes by, people are dying.
Right.
So the police, you know, responses have changed dramatically. Well, a lot of school shootings, especially, are stylized suicide. And so, like you said, when faced with any resisting lethal force, a lot of times the assailants will simply kill themselves. That was their plan all along, to either kill themselves or be killed by the police. And so that has become standard in response packages, too. But then you get a weird hybrid event like the Orlando atrocity, where there's a mass shooting, which turns into a barricade situation, which almost seems like hostage-taking, so we should do negotiating. But instead, it's just a chance to get a PR message out and to do more killing.
Right.
So that's a real challenge to responses, because it's our natural tendency and our police agency's natural tendency to, if there's a barricade situation, let's talk.
Yeah.
Let's resolve it in some other way. And I think it's going to spawn a whole lot of unpleasant discussions about making a very tough decision. Is this a barricade that we can talk our way out of, or is this a barricade that we're going to have to enter and shoot our way out of? This is, you know, these kinds of things are only going to get more common because they put police in a quandary. And chaos management is one of the jobs of criminals and terrorists, is to make things confusing and to sabotage the police response.
Well, and it seems like, too, that if, and we got to go to break here, but if our own response to these events is ineffective because we are handling them improperly, then they will continue to do said events as long as they continue to work. But let's hold this thought. We're talking with Dr. William April right now. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio! Stop it, Jack. Brought to you by Daniel Events, the country's leading manufacturer of air rifles and accessories. Daniel Events, lighter, stronger, better. The co-host is ruining my ads. This segment brought to you by Surefire! Know your target and what is beyond it. But how can you really know your target? By shining a really, really, really bright light at it. And that's where Surefire comes in. From the USB rechargeable 300 lumen sidekick to the 500 lumen X300 Ultra M600 Scout Light, Surefire can make sure you never have to yell, "Aziz, light!" ever again. Doesn't matter if you're shining a light at a potential threat or just helping your friends see through their eyelids. When you need all the lumens for longer, you need Surefire. So, have you noticed that when I'm reading the ads, I like twist and wring my hands really oddly? I don't know why I do that. And let's not ask Dr. William April either. Cause
I was going to say, we have someone who could probably help you with your anxiety there, John.
I don't think it's anxiety. I think I just have to do something.
No one ever thinks it's anxiety, unless they want a script.
Anyway.
That's right, Jack.
Well, you would, wow. You know what?
Watch yourself.
Yeah, right? We're talking with Dr. William April. We were talking about terrorist events and barricaded hostage takers versus barricaded terrorists who are seeking more PR. And how do we recognize that, I guess?
Well, I think it's not just that they want more PR. I mean, obviously they want to stake out their version of the narrative.
Right.
But meanwhile, they're consolidating resources. They're consolidating captives into smaller locations, and they're waiting to kill them.
Right.
They're making preparations to kill them. The noted trainer Greg Elifritz has made this point very, very clearly, that there's got to be some reconsideration of what to do. The contraction to a barricaded circumstance has been to date, kind of a pause in things. Well, let's pause and see what's going on. Let's see if we can establish communication. Well, if the bad guys using that pause to make his event more lethal, we really got to rethink the appropriateness of allowing that pause to occur.
Right. Right. Well, and I plan on having Greg on the show as soon as he's available. He's been busy of late, and talking more in depth on that. But I wanted to bring it up with you since we were kind of discussing at the beginning of the show, and then, as often is the case, we started talking about things completely unintended from what we discussed beforehand, which I apologize for. But let's shift gears one more time. Tell me about the training event that you and Sherman House are putting together, and what that's for, and who's going to be there, and all that jazz.
Well, July 31st, there'll be a fundraiser, a training event that we're calling Hebrew Hogger 2016, Training and Pork Raiser. It's in Nashville, Tennessee, and it's designed to raise funds to save a family farm.
Right.
That farm's been endangered by the legal fees incurred by a noted trainer in the community, Eli Miller, who was involved in a lawful self-defense episode early in 2016. And though he hasn't been charged, the financial distress of defending yourself is extraordinary. And the family farm's been put in a lot of jeopardy, and so we're trying to raise some money to save the farm, to put it that simply. In Nashville, it's a one-day training. Sherman House, the people's dentist, obviously is going to be presenting on his concept of the civilian defender, which I think is very interesting.
Yep.
I'm going to be there talking about violent acts and actors, sort of the developmental path from normal to dangerous. Claude Werner, the tactical professor, well-known personality in the industry, will be there talking about strategy, tactics, and options for personal protection. We're going to have a very interesting thing from Dana McClendon, a practicing attorney and gun rights activist on the laws of self-defense beyond the basics. Paul Sharp, the noted trainer police officer from Illinois, will be there doing a block on edged weapons, knife combatives. He has a very interesting take on that. And we've got John Jane presenting on he's an EMT and a police officer in Nashville, and he'll be presenting on medical solutions for the civilian defender, meaning the kinds of injuries that show up in an attack on a civilian, whether it's a mass casualty event or a small-scale interpersonal violence event. What can the civilian defender do in the moment? So I think it's a really broad range of materials that we're going to cover, and it's only $100. So it's quite affordable for the amount of stuff that we're going to have going on.
Well, and I know I'm pretty certain Jack's going to be going down to that.
Mm-hmm. We better get more lunch then.
Well, there's
you're going to have extra if I come though.
Well,
right.
She actually eats more than anyone her size has any right to.
She's like a hummingbird.
Is that what it is?
She like has to eat her own body weight to keep functioning.
Huh.
Otherwise, we get hangry Melody.
Like that explanation. That works.
Yeah.
I'm hummingbird Melody.
Jeez. All right.
We'll get more food.
Yes, that's I would hope that the pig farm would have enough, you know, to go around, but I don't know. So yes, be forewarned.
Well,
Jack will be there. Melody might be there. I'm going to try and make it if I can. I've got a conflicting event that I'm trying very hard to get out of, but it's going to be an amazing thing that is helping out a really good dude. And also, too, if you don't like liberal media, you can annoy them, because I know I saw the article in the paper that got posted online the other day, and their take on what the training event was really, really funny.
I like that they called Sherman a civilian presenter, and he's like, well yes, I am.
it is interesting, you know, that people are pointing out some of those inconsistencies and corrections in the newspaper's approach to the event. Have been changing, which is nice to say, and then hopefully maybe their presentations of the actual events that spurred all of this will change over time as well. Another thing is that that we're happy about is that this event actually gives Eli a chance to get back to what he does, which is growing fantastic pork and then selling those heirloom pork products. So you know, folks that come to the training also have a chance to get some of the best pork you will ever eat.
Well, and there you go. We've got a couple minutes. Here, let's talk about this for a second. And this is kind of important and a distinction that I don't think enough people make. You know, you just mentioned that Eli's wanting to get back to doing what he does. I don't think people outside of our culture really understand how much we are just trying to avoid trouble on a daily basis and how much of our training is centered around that. Why do you think that perception is not more widely known outside of our industry or the people interested?
The standard take on this is that if people take an interest in their own self-defense, then, quote, the streets will run red with blood. My argument is that the streets are already running red with blood. There are millions of violent crimes committed every year. I find it interesting that people are morally offended by opposition to violent crime, by physical response to violent crime. But that sort of blood running in the streets is a crisis that we have to deal with. And I think it bespeaks a kind of sad and jaded acceptance of the fact that we're all subject to violent crime whenever a violent criminal feels like dishing some of it out. Well, I think a lot of other people absolutely reject that premise. And I think the country would be a lot better off if every time someone tried to hurt an innocent person, they got hurt for it.
Yeah.
I think that might change things for the better. And I do find it funny that people tend to oppose that. The standard take on people taking an interest in their own self-defense is that we're obsessed with violence.
Yeah.
Well, we're not. any more than people who have a fire extinguisher are obsessed with fire.
Right.
That fire drills at schools are because schools are obsessed with fire. They're realities in the world, and I think dealing with them is a better approach than pretending they don't exist.
Well, and it seems like it's funny you mention this, and plenty of people have said it, but I was not arguing with someone that was anti-gun, but I was having a conversation with someone that was not pro-gun, I guess. And they were asking me what I thought should be done to reduce gun violence in the country. And I pointed out, and once not an original thought to me, all sorts of people have said similar. I'm paraphrasing all sorts of really talented people. But, well, if every time someone, you know, tried to hurt or murder someone else, if they got shot and either died or put in jail, eventually we'd run out of people doing it, or at least we would thin the numbers doing it to the point where it was not as common of an occurrence, you know?
So. Absolutely. I mean, any event, I mean, it's kind of simple economic modeling. If there's a certain timely and severe consequence for any behavior, you're going to see less of that behavior. Mm-hmm. And so you're starting to see more and more really rubber meets the road judgments borne out by research. And sexual assault is very clear. Any resistance to sexual assault lowers the rate of completed sexual assault.
Right.
This shouldn't be rocket science, and yet apparently it is.
Yeah.
Well, if the response every single time a man, and it is a man most of the time, tried to rape a woman, he got stabbed in the face for it. Well, that would really put a dent in the rate of completed rape, and I would argue eventually in the rate of attempted rape.
Right. Well, yeah, if you knew that's what was coming, it would certainly change your thought process. Now, we're at the end of the show. William, I really appreciate you taking time joining us today. If people want to find you online, where can they do it at?
Well, I'm working on a website, which is teaching me patience, April, APRILL, Risk Consulting. And if you want more information about the training event, the fundraising training event for the Hebrew Hogger, you can go to revolverscience.com, or there's a Facebook page under Hebrew Hogger. I really do appreciate the chance today.
Yeah, no worries, man. I always love having you on, and I will talk to you soon. Be safe, man. So anyway, thanks for listening, everyone. As always, make sure you check out our website at ballisticradio.com, like our Facebook page at facebook.com/ballisticradio, and keep leaving those 5-star reviews on iTunes. We really appreciate it. Thanks for listening. As always, be safe. See you next week. Blah, 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 blah. Bye-bye.